This is the Holden Forum, a weekly event. And while I've been at Holden a total of 3 weeks now, over 2 years, this is the first one I've ever attended, and so that's why I'm the moderator. For those of you who were at my session earlier, I can model not being the expert as a way of leading this. Tonight's forum, let me talk a little bit about what the question is that we're going to be discussing, and then talk a little bit about the format. And those of you who have more expertise or experience, if you have any suggestions about how we do this, please feel free to raise them before we get started. The question that in discussing with the teaching staff, we thought we might want to pose and think about is the one that's listed up here. How do we reconcile the existence of war with a God of peace? The timing of this question is somewhat related to the fact that, again, tomorrow is the 4th of July, and the 4th of July is often replete with symbols of patriotism and nationalism, and it also was a symbol of the war for independence that this country went through. And the other reason why I felt like this was a good question to bring this week in terms of the resources that are here. We have a couple people here who have some experience and have done a lot of thinking about the situation in the Middle East. And we also have people here who have done a lot of thinking about the whole issue of peace in relation to children, Pam, and some other people who have done some thinking about our relationship with our planet and the level of the question about what kind of dominion over or what level of intervention we can or cannot establish in relation to our planet. So it seemed like both in terms of the time of the 4th of July and the teaching staff we had here that this would be an interesting question to engage. The format that I'd like to follow tonight is really to present this as a question for us as a community, to try to create some dialogue and some understanding. Not necessarily to reach any particular conclusions except our own personal ones. And so I'd like to ask that we sort of go by the golden rule. Both listen and speak as if we are, doing unto others as we'd want done unto ourselves. I will play a fairly laid back moderation role unless I feel like that basic principle is not being followed. So I'm going to try to ensure that everybody who wants to speak has an opportunity to do that. And in some cases, that may mean that the teaching staff who come with some preset presentations, I may start going like this and asking you to shorten it. But in general, we want to try to get as much dialogue, different points of view out, and gain as much understanding as we can about how different ones of us approach this kind of a question. Because I think it's a question that many of us have thought about, particularly in the last year, because of the events of the Gulf War. The other thing I want to say is that one of the reasons why this issue is very present for me is that some of you may know that I'm Jewish and that I'm married to a woman who is Lutheran. And now all of you know that. There are many ways in which we feel that we have more in common with each other in terms of the role that God and spirituality and religion plays in our lives than we have that's different. I have lots of Jewish friends who, go to synagogue a couple times a year, and that's about what religion means to them. And my wife has friends who are what she calls two-timers also. People go on Christmas and Easter. While I can't say we go to synagogue and church every week, we are both people who God and the existence of God is something that's very present in our lives in a very day-to-day way, even if some of the dogma and liturgy that we subscribe to may be slightly different. But one place where we've had a lot of discussion has to do with the whole question of how do we think about violence, and how do we think about in particular, whether or not the use of violence is appropriate or consistent with our spiritual and religious beliefs. Now, the issue that always comes to mind for me is the Holocaust. and the way in which I feel like, while in general I may have be a peace-loving person and somebody who would support peace, there is a situation where I feel like from my gut, the only response I can have is, if somebody's going to try to kill off my people, I'm going to respond by trying to kill them. And it's something that I'm not all that comfortable with, but something that it's a dilemma that I'm faced with. Whereas my wife, with her position is, well, if enough people had just said no to Adolf Hitler, if enough people had said no, we're not going to let you do this in nonviolent kinds of ways, maybe it never would have happened. And I just can't. It's hard for me to accept that, even though a part of me says that I really, in other ways and under other issues, feel that that's important. So that's a place where this question very much personally touches me. What I'd like to do to sort of kick things off, besides just sort of presenting my personal relationship to this issue, is to ask a couple of the teaching staff who have prepared some things to speak, and then we'll have reactions from the audience and questions and discussion. And then at a certain point, I'll say, okay, I'd like to hear from a couple more teaching staff, and then we'll go back and forth. So I didn't warn anybody about this. This is all very free-flowing and spontaneous. But I'm going to ask David to start, since he's the first person in my view. And then I'm going to ask Carla, and then we'll have some reactions from the group, and then I'll pull from other teaching staff. Okay. David, do you want to kick your side off?
Yeah. Sure. I want to start by saying I echo Rick's concerns, and I think probably many people in the room here, that it's been a struggle for me most of my life of examining what role of war. The Vietnam War was a major part of my childhood and young adult life, and so I wrestled with that. And this past year, I wrestled with the Gulf War a lot, and I'm going to confine my thoughts right now really to the Gulf War. And I guess I could start by saying I saw A Tale of Two Cities sitting over there. And this fall, I've often talked about the United Nations, which is right across the street from where I work, which was a major institution and player in the Gulf War, as a tale of two organizations. There was a real possibility this fall, with Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, to show the world, to set an example once and for all, or at least an initial step, that we can resolve international conflicts. We can confine and stop brutal dictators without resort to military action. There were real possibilities for international cooperation, to use sanctions, economic sanctions, to use diplomatic means. The level of cooperation among the nations was quite extraordinary. And yet at the same time, the process that the UN went through this fall was one of the most extraordinary examples of arm twisting and coercion and manipulation that turned it from a house of peace into a house of war. That really turned the UN from its charter, which says that to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, because it was founded right after World War II, to authorizing military action, which is in the charter as well, but really using that as the first step. So I think that was one of the major casualties. And so I want to just touch on what I think are a couple of the casualties of the war as a way of answering this question, as well as some of the causes. And I'll start with a little story. We had high school groups that came in, I told many folks this. And so we're trying to think, well, how do you get high school students to wrestle with these issues of war and peace? And one of the things we did was we sent them out to Arab missions to meet with diplomats from countries in the Arab world beyond just the immediate countries of Iraq and Kuwait, to get a sense of what was the impact on the region. Because the war doesn't always, war never affects just the people with the guns or being shot at. And one of the groups, a number of our groups went to Yemen, which was the only Arab mission on the Security Council. and was quite ardent in its opposition to both Iraq's invasion and acts of aggression and the United States' efforts to mobilize the UN to use economic sanctions, which would hurt the Iraqi people, and use military force. And the ambassador of Yemen said to every group that came there, he said, you know, there's a name for this war. We have a name for this war. It's the war of the rich against the poor. And I think that to answer this question of the relationship between the existence of God, a God of peace, and the continuing presence of war, we have to examine that war is almost invariably, and you can, you know, throughout history, there's an aspect of it that is a war against the poor, and usually supports the powerful and rich. And you just have to dig around for a while and you'll sort out and you'll find those on one side or another. And that to me was striking, is that you had basically a very powerful, wealthy nation like the United States mobilizing one country after another to protect another wealthy state. And I think, frankly, in terms of the United States' role, there were no moral reasons, there was no, you know, religious reasons for this. It was strictly crass politics and economic interest. There's a saying, folks have said that if the main export of Kuwait was not oil but broccoli, we wouldn't have been there. And I think that's true. That we, in effect, and the reason I'm dwelling on these sort of political economic causes is to show that religion comes in, because if we said we're there to protect our oil and we don't care who's there and we'll kill anybody we need to, that's not going to generate an awful lot of international support. So suddenly theology comes in, religion comes in, to explain why it is we're doing these otherwise nasty things. And that's where it touches on this issue, that God is being manipulated and redefined by the powerful on both sides. And if you look at the rhetoric of Hussein and calling for a jihad, and the rhetoric of George Bush and saying, look, this was a just war, before, during, and after, he was quite clear that we were right, they were wrong. And then he said, you know, yes, there was a little opposition, but face it, they were wrong. That, to me, is an incredible manipulation of religion and denies the real authenticity of religious values and the diversity of the different traditions in the Middle East.
Hey, can I start you back?
I'm just going to stop.
Okay, good. Great. Carla, can I ask you to sort of react, and then
sure. We'll
open it up to some discussion.
Carla, excuse me, we can't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I wonder if you could
set that up. All right. When I get asked a question like that the night before, I sit this far back in the room, hoping I won't be heard too closely. That's the beginning, and my thoughts are not necessarily sequential. It was such a good topic linking these three areas because the issue of violence and the way the planet and women and other nations are treated are, of course, all linked, not only economically and politically, but spiritually as well. We do violence to other flesh, we do violence to the flesh and blood of the planet, and we even do violence to our own flesh and blood, and that's the way it is. We've lost a sense of anything being sacred. We are entranced with a vision of the world that is false and is what the Bible simply calls idolatry. It's theologically, it seems that simple. To me, and yet so much a part of me that it's like trying to describe my own nose. And so every now and then I get a glimpse of it, but I basically barely do. And we're fine. The notion that my peace I leave you, my peace I give you, my peace I give you, my peace I leave with you, it struck me when you asked me to reflect on that. And that moment in the life of our Lord and in our own lives. And it seems like in some wild and distorted way we are finding our peace in all sorts of sick and crazy and ugly ways. By way of response, I guess we can start by doing what we're doing tonight, acknowledging that there's a war going on, that in some ways, in awful ways, and I learned that in garbology today, and I've learned it in a lot of other ways. There are ways that we are part of the war. There are ways that we can make some changes so that we are less a part of that war. But there are also ways that Archbishop Raymond Hunthausen taught me this about 10 years ago when he stopped paying his taxes for war. There's acts of courage and defiance and risking and sacrifice that are also opportunities for us in becoming as little a part of finding our peace in the wrong place as we can. And so I ask myself, what risks and sacrifices am I willing to make? And I'll close this rambling thing by it. The image that comes to me so often, and I'm not sure why these days, but it came to me a lot during the Gulf War, and also a couple of years ago when the Valdez oil spill happened in both cases. As a child, I had a tradition at Christmas to always watch the Christmas Carol with Alastair Sim. Any of you familiar with that version of it? And of course, he's brought through re-seeing his life as the nightmare of idolatry that it was in all kinds of ways. And he's made to look at it over and over again. And one angel after another shows him what he has been and done. And finally he's faced with his own death and with his own grave. And then, of course, the great moment, he wakes up and, oh, good Lord, the sun is out. I'm alive. I have another chance. And it seems to me that during this critical time in the life of our world, we're all called to be, in some ways, mystics, radicals, peacemakers, and with the same, although we don't know how the mystery of that question makes any sense, like Scrooge, to wake up and see, my God, there's one more day. The world hasn't blown up or fallen apart yet, and with the same energy, wonder, and delight in just that one moment of time that he had, which was that morning, get out there and do the best we can.
Reactions?
Yeah. Are we trying to tackle the question of reconciling the existence of war with a God of peace, or are we trying to discuss the political niceties or points, counterpoints of specific wars? I mean, there have been comments made about the war in the Gulf, and we can sit down and discuss that for hours, whether it was a just war or not, or is there such a thing as a just war. We can talk about World War II and all the atrocities of World War II. It strikes me that the question was reconciling the existence of war, whether it's with two swords, bows and arrows, nuclear weapons, whatever, with a God of peace. And are we looking for something in the nature of God that allows the existence of war in the human sphere? I think it's a bigger question than just whether or not you happen to believe that what went on in the Gulf is the right thing to do or not.
Yeah, I mean, my belief is that it's such a big question that we have to try to get at it in any way we can. For some of us, we need to take concrete situations, and we have to say, okay, now, how do I deal with this? How do I understand it? Like a political situation, the political niceties, as you say, of something in the Gulf. My own way is trying to understand these two things that tear at me, these two sets of feelings that I have. For this purpose of this discussion, I want us to make it possible that however people need to approach it, we want to hear it, because while one way may not be applicable to you, it may be to somebody else, and maybe we can see where we go. So I'd be interested, given that question, how do you see it? I mean, how do you try it?
The way I personally see it, it becomes an issue of free will and human choice. That whenever we are faced with a situation where we personally have some type of goal, or we're interested in acquiring something, we're interested in power, whatever, we have choices that we can make in terms of how we behave. And so the existence of war is really a human enterprise. Mm-hmm. That it is something that we fabricate out of all the things we have within our power to do. We can craft things with our hands. Whether we choose to make plowshares or swords is up to us. Mm-hmm. We make these choices. The choices were given to us to make. Mm-hmm. Which way we go is up to us. Mm-hmm. If you talk about war, my problem is with an underlying issue to that, and that is evil itself. Mm-hmm. Because I see war as the intentional application of misfortune on others. And it's the intent where the evil lies. And I have problems wrestling with the issue of why does evil itself exist? Why is there, among all the range of human choices, the possibility of doing this to each other? Why does this exist in the universe at all?
Well, I'd like to refer to Job, where God allowed Satan to do these things to Job, and except that he was not allowed to kill Job. And through all this persecution, Job still remained faithful to God and won out in the end. In other words, there are many, many Jewish people that survived the Holocaust, and they are great because they have shared the strengthening of their faith through that persecution. For instance, Elie Wiesel and Corrie Ten Boom, many of those people have become great because of the reason they survived was because they stuck with God, and they put their and centered their lives on God. So that's sort of paradoxical. I mean, why does God persecute us? Is it because he wants us to become more faithful to him? You see what I mean? I mean, is God testing us by persecuting us with war? Is God testing us? So, of course, I'm raising other questions that are not understandable, but in the same scripture, there is a saying that we see through the mirror darkly, and then when we reach heaven, we will see God face to face and understand everything. And I think it's how we perceive these realities in the light of God. It's how we look at the situation through God's eyes.
Well, you know, I listened to the two instructors, and I agree in theory with both the further other speakers. But I think we ought to have a definition of terms, too. We heard the allusion of a war against environmental abuse. We heard the issue of a war of ethics for this speaker. Now, are we talking about armed conflict? Are we speaking of nuclear holocaust? Are we speaking of a well-devised, concerted effort against abuse? Are we speaking of an effort against crime? Are we speaking of an effort against evil? What is the term war? Yet war is, after all, a human invention. War was devised for greed. War devised to impose one will upon the will of another. And so, to me, it would appear that when God said there will always be wars and rumors of wars, that he had a pretty good insight into we humans. And that he knew that he would conquer, that he would rule, that God is not going to be dispossessed by the feeble efforts of we greedy people. And we're all greedy. We all have a war, one kind or another. There's a war against the environmental disgracers, or here's a war against ethics. Here was an illusion of a war against one super nation, so called by the progenitor of it, against an evil vermin nation. What are we really talking about? We're talking about the weakness of we human beings who rather would choose evil than good.
Well, it may be that in this short period of time tonight, we don't have enough time to talk about the nature of God and the existence of evil in the world. Maybe it would be helpful to focus just a little bit more just on the Persian Gulf War and some of the things that we feel about that. And I just want to go on record saying I think sanctions should have been tried a lot longer than they were.
I had somebody over here. Did you want to speak? The guy, I'm sorry, I thought I saw your hand.
I think they were just pointing out that there was someone behind you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Dave?
Rick, to me, one of the most distressing things about the Gulf War was the reaction after the war was completed. I know the issue of the war itself and the just cause of that is important, and I mean, I agree with what's been said, but in my community, which is in New Orleans, there were those on like St. Martin's Table, which is a lot of older people are there, who an active role in presenting their views that this is the wrong way to proceed, and they were just shunned in the community, and it was not in the community of St. Martin, but in the overall community, and it was to me just the parades that have happened and whatnot. I think that really says a lot about, you know, 4th of July tomorrow, but what we, you know, value as a nation and how we proceed from here. Because I think, you know, I teach school, and weapons are the glorious icons of our culture now. The patriots are, kids just love them. They're neat. They play with them. And I think that is really, really what's the most dangerous part of this war, is what it portends for the future. And how can we as Christians help work with that?
You know, there's a couple of themes that I guess I'm hearing beginning to emerge in relation to the question. And it's kind of, I don't know if it's surprising or not, but one of them is there's some people, I think, in the room who feel that, to a certain extent, war is inevitable. It is part of God's creation. It is something that is about being human. And there's others who are saying, wait a minute, war isn't inevitable, that there is some way that if we can come closer to God, that war wouldn't actually need to exist or would never exist. And I think depending on where you fall on that position, you're going to approach this question very differently, regardless of what your definitions are. Let me ask at this point, if I'm just going to ask Pam and Bob, if you could sort of throw in your two cents about the question, and you can either address the way where we're at now or whatever you had prepared before.
I feel that it begins with problem solving, and as a teacher, I'm in a lucky situation to be able to start with the kids when they're younger, and I feel that teaching the skills of problem solving through a concept or an issue raises the awareness, raises their awareness. I feel that the concepts of peace or justice or injustice or war is a skill to teach them to how to look at it on both perspectives. That's what I do in my classroom, and that's what I do in my Sunday school class with my friend Karen. kids need, we need to start with those issues at a very young age. I feel that we need to model, not only as parents, but as the general community. However we come intact with younger people, we need to constantly display that model. And it grows and it nurtures from a small basis and it builds. I feel that group compromise and group consensus and higher level thinking skills is where we need to be, I'll just say, in our society, in our communities, in our home, in our classrooms, and in our Sunday school classes, in our churches. And from that, we learn the skills of how to listen, of how to talk, how to speak with one another. And that is a tough issue, I find, for adults. I find it a lot easier to start with a smaller age and build on that. I don't feel that you can just throw out a concept of war or peace and say, gosh, what is that? Let's look it up and let's define it. And how's that apply to this and this? You have to touch it. And you have to teach the skill of how to touch that. You have to act it out. You have to problem solve it. You have to make it. And you have to look at both sides of the issue. In to reflect on the Gulf War quickly, in a classroom, I'm sure we solved the whole Middle East crisis several times, but we had the very special leaders in the community and in the world come into that classroom, and I think that that's how we need to do it too. We had the head of King Hussein's palace come in and talk to us from Jordan. People from the government, people from, you know, the legislature, the mayor, other teachers, bankers, the community come in, and then we outlined it. You know, we compared those things with diagramming, all kinds of diagramming with visual organizers. So we're writing about it and we're touching it, we're feeling, we're looking at where is it. Okay, and then we look at historical, we look at timelines. I think that timelines for all of us are very important. I think that you can even bring into a classroom the religious aspects. But as you will see tomorrow night, what Karen and I have done with the concept of peace and hope and justice has been a hands-on, and it's been from the language from the children. We did not give it to them. They did it. And that's what you will see tomorrow night as a skeleton and as something to bounce off from. And I would like for every adult to think, gosh, I could be a model to this child because that's where they need to start. I spoke to someone today and I didn't get all of my feelings out, but with all my heart, I meant to this person, oh, you know, you're young, you're vivacious, you're this person who can be this wonderful model because you have to say everything right to these children, not just me and not just the parent, not just the teacher, but, you know, the significant others that these kids look up to. And I think we need to watch what we say, how we speak to the kids.
Certainly addressing the diversity of subjects here tonight. I want to address the one that was started back here about the question of the deeper question, the philosophical, theological questions. And I want to start by saying these are not just philosophical questions, they're very deep personal questions for me because I was a naval officer in charge of guns on a destroyer off the coast of Vietnam in the winter of 65-66. And trying to think of one or two concrete examples, but and the one that came most vividly to mind, probably the greatest injustice that I saw, was one day we were about 20 miles offshore and we noticed some airplanes dive bombing over the horizon nearer the coast than we were. So we cranked up the boilers and headed in to take a look, see what was going on. And these planes were, for some strange reason, they were American-built aircraft belonging to the Vietnamese Air Force, and they were dive-bombing a fishing fleet, a group of sampans. And we came along, and another ship comes steaming over the horizon. No one knew what was going on, and they radioed asking us frantically what was going on. And our captain said, "Well, I can't tell. We don't have a scorecard." And later on, several bodies were fished out of the water. I don't know whether that fishing fleet had anything to do with Viet Cong or the enemy, so-called. But that and other episodes has persuaded me that true evil really exists. And while we wrestle with these questions, they're not just philosophical problems. They're real existential problems that I have had to deal with and many people who went to Vietnam. The question, of course, the classic question is what's sometimes called theodicy, or the problem of evil. That is how, if there's in the tradition, we mandate an all-powerful God who is also all-loving, and yet evil exists. I fundamentally believe that evil does exist, and that leaves us a question. How in the world can this awful things go on when you have a God who's both all-powerful and all-loving? And it's by wrestling with that, and briefly, the solution, which there's no solutions. You ran through about six or seven of them in very quick form. But I think the only one that even begins to make sense, and that finally doesn't make sense for various reasons, is the fact that that we have to restrict our understandings of an all-powerful God. I think we must retain the answer of an all-loving God. Otherwise, life does not make sense. In the Christian tradition, the problem isn't having all power. It's how do we live in a world of sin? How do we gain some sense of reconciliation in a world that's separated and alienated? So I'm quite willing to sacrifice the all-powerful God. I don't know whether God doesn't have the power or has the power, doesn't exercise. It really doesn't make much difference because the effect that we feel is the same. I personally believe that maybe God does have the power, doesn't use it. And the reason I have always cited is the same reason that you have cited and others, is that for some reason, God wishes to allow human freedom. And all this, of course, it doesn't mean that God is powerless. We have built in the tradition, I think erroneously, a model of an all-powerful God for various historical reasons, which you in part alluded to, and you can go into that part of the tradition, male tradition of the church, and perhaps a little bit of wish fulfillment. But we've got a conceivable way of God acting with power that also preserves human freedom. And the only way that I can conceive of that is through some understanding of the power that God exerting is love, because that's both powerful. But the main problem is sin and alienation, then the power of God is the only power that can overcome that. Hence, that must be the way that God operates in the world. And of course, this perspective rules out any understanding of miracles in which God somehow intervenes in the courses of nature. The way that God operates, in my opinion, is love, which can be resisted and rejected by human beings, and frequently is. Why do humans then go to war, and how do you reconcile it? Well, the reason we go to war is, for some reason, the process that we're in is an evolutionary process, where this group of human, the species we call human beings, has evolved over thousands of years. We have developed certain instincts of aggression, which in certain contexts were helped to us to survive as a species. In an era when there's many of us and we like to fight each other, those same instincts come into trouble. For whatever reason, God has granted us the freedom to exercise those instincts as groups. Groups both magnify those instincts. Culture magnifies the instincts and, at the same time, in many cases, restrains those instincts of aggression and self-interest. But ultimately, there is no force, either God or, in our organization of the world, no states, any system, which controls states. And I'm not sure if we would want any system to do that, because that raises questions of totalitarianism on a large scale. But for whatever reason, we are both by God and by other nations free to exercise our aggressive instincts in our own self-interest, and we do that. And consequently, we have war, and the only restraining force that I can see is God's love, which we have a capacity to respond to and sometimes do as well, and hence there is peace. In conclusion, how do we reconcile these two things? Well, I'm not sure we do. I would suggest, however, a couple strategies. One is the first is a healthy realism about the way things are, and we don't quite understand why they are that way, why God has created a world in which we can do such awful atrocities to each other, and you've cited a number of them already. Second thing I would say is that we need to work and witness, even though we're not going to overcome war tomorrow or the next day, or I think not short of the second coming. There is, things could be worse, and we can restrain some wars, and it's time to work for peace and justice, and that means anything from pacifism. I would suggest in the Christian tradition, a pacifist perspective is a legitimate Christian perspective, to a perspective of the just war tradition, which advocates the best way to prevent wars, to balance power against power. I think both of those are defendable Christian positions, and about the only way we can reconcile ourselves with a God of love, and yet with our persistent tendency to aggress on each other.
Thanks, Bob. More to react to. Yeah.
I've been thinking about the question, as we've all been talking, how do we reconcile the existence of war with the God of peace? And the part of that I've heard mentioned several times that's really, I'm questioning this, but the phrase God of peace, my God is a God of peace, and I don't believe that if I anthropomorphize my conception of God, I don't believe that person of God advocates or feels war has an inevitability in the lives of human people. But I think that one of the things that people of God do oftentimes without thinking or realizing it, which was apparent to me last night when we did the cultural exercise, oftentimes our culture tells us things that we don't necessarily hear with our hearts. And the example that I'm thinking of is the way that we, as Christians and as people of God, use language about God. And we've heard the words mighty, and we've heard the words powerful. We sing songs about Christian soldiers, and we sing songs about soldiers of the cross, and we sing songs about mighty fortresses. And all of these images are images of wars, images of power over other people. They are not a nurturing and caring and loving imagery that we even use in our Christian life and in our references to God and Christ. And I think that sometimes one of the things that continues to be most difficult for me to reconcile is how we as Christians and people of God have supported wars in the past. And it doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't make sense to my head, and it doesn't make sense to my heart that Christian people can say to each other and to the world that war is okay. And I think one of the reasons perhaps that those...
There is something, the other instance was an instance where I was working with a very divided community group, and I had them for a retreat for a weekend to try to reconcile some differences. And it was a group that was trying to come to some compromise about a transportation issue in a community. And there were the pro-growthers, and there were the environmentalists, and they all wanted to try to come to some consensus around this issue without having to do a very expensive either legal battles in the courts or political battles in the electorate. They wanted to be able to resolve this peaceably. And there was this moment when a mouse came in the room. This is very evocative, I have to say. And one of the people that was an environmentalist, without thinking about it, did the same exact thing. He stamped him dead. And it was like a shockwave right through the room, because first of all, it was completely against what people's stereotypes were about who would do such a thing, and it also made just the act of violence that occurred right there. I don't want to get into a whole big thing about whether we should kill mice or not mice, but just the act of violence took people to a different level in terms of what they were talking about and made them realize that they really did need to take seriously trying to work this out amongst themselves. And no amount of facilitation and, you know, great decision-making processes compared to that moment when people just felt inside themselves, you know, how awful that was and how they wanted to try to work it out. And, I mean, we are talking, I mean, there is an underlying current here, the issue of, you know, we do have that violence in ourselves. We do have that piece of ourselves that just on the moment, no matter who we want ourselves to be, we have that evil side. The question that, again, seems to divide us here is that inevitable? And do we somehow just come to terms with it as best we can? And what are some of the ways that we can do that? One of which that Bob's saying is we have to acknowledge it and not ignore it and not pretend that it doesn't exist. Or is it something we can in fact go beyond? Is our notion of God and a God of peace one that says that we can move beyond having that instinct?
Or both.
I mean,
Niebuhr said years ago, war is inevitable but not necessary. There's no war that's necessary. We can do a lot to avoid wars. Doesn't mean that we're going to stop all wars, however.
I was impressed, the only thing that impressed me encouragingly at the preparation for this Gulf War was the debate in Congress. It was the first time that I can remember when it was put up for debate. And there was congressman and senator after another who stood up and pleaded for further sanctions. And they laid their political life on the line there. And I think, I mean, I didn't like the results of it. We lost that round. But maybe that's the first round in finding some kind of a solution where we can avoid these terrible, terrible catastrophes.
I just want to echo that and add to it by saying it was the first war, certainly in my experience, but also in my own readings of other wars where there was writing and loud noises made about it, and lots of pictures of dying birds and waters. And not only from this is a valuable resource, why are we messing it up point of view, but even in the popular press there was a sense that it's ethically wrong to do this. And I thought, this is progress. This is an awful thing that's happened, but at least people are acknowledging it as wrong.
Come in a second, I want to get people who haven't spoken first. Yes.
Maybe I'm going to present the other side a little bit. I'm at a loss to understand why the fact that that a madman dictator was occupying the country and killing its citizens on a daily basis, why we should have ignored that or gone on with the ruse that sanctions were going to get him to remove his troops. That's a question.
I think that's maybe where I can come in a little bit tenuously, trepidatiously. It does bother me when the discussion focuses just on the actions and the bombings and so on that we did as a country, although I believe it was terribly wrong and ill-placed at that point in time. Yes, Saddam Hussein was an ever-present and ever-consistent evil throughout this whole process. There's no question of that. But the question is, where does he fit into the whole context and the history of that situation, and what our role is from a country halfway around the world, and what our real motivation was for getting involved in that war in the first place? And I would suggest that we didn't care about the people of the world. If we did, we would care about the Tibetans or the Ethiopians or the other powerless people that don't have any economic value to us. And we might intervene in those situations too. The world is full of sorrowful situations, but we don't intervene there because our vested interests aren't at stake. Another thing that I thought a reason that we went in that wasn't stated for politically expedient reasons is that the global balance of powers would have been seriously upset if someone in the Middle East had gained control, whoever that person is. And it's to our advantage to maintain an imbalance of power there. And I think that one of the things that we have to do as Christians, as peacemakers, as citizens of a democracy, is to seriously and consistently question the motivations of our government. Our government was established on the basis, if I am interpreting our whole history correctly, is that governments are not to be trusted. no government is to be trusted, no leader is to be trusted. And the whole system of the Constitution is to call every public servant into question. And when we, as a nation, get into a situation where we believe that that process is one where you're unpatriotic to protest, to question, then I think we've lost the initial impact, the initial idea of what our nation's about. And maybe I've got off an answer to your question. I'm sorry if I have. So. Yeah, Saddam Hussein was an evil one. But the question is, Stalin was an evil. We played with Stalin for years. You know, they're consistent evils, and we were willing to work with the policy of containment with the Soviet Union. Why did we have to rush in and not be satisfied with containment with a very hopeful-looking situation of sanctions? Yes, it would have taken some time. Yes, he was killing people. But the Kuwaiti government has gone in and persecuted and killed people, too. And we're not going in and removing the Kuwaiti government after they've been reinstated.
Before we go on, I've been given a 5-minute notice, and I'm not sure what it's about from the tape people. What's the guidelines here in terms of time?
We have to stop it in 5 minutes. There's something else scheduled in this room.
Oh.
Okay.
5 minutes.
Yep. It's an hour forum. You can continue your conversation informally after that, but this is finishing in 5 minutes.
Okay.
Well, now we've resolved all the issues.
I am absolutely clear, and I'm sure we're gonna finish the questions. I've got one here. Let me just make sure before we finish, I know who wants to be able to speak, just so I can divide it up. I've got you. I've got David. Anybody else? Okay.
Okay. Point along with this gentleman over here to a degree. One of the greatest generals we ever had was General Douglas MacArthur, whether you agree or not. He said the war is the ultimate disgrace of mankind. And immediately upon the conquering of Japan, he instituted a recovery program that only the United States was interested in, and developed this country into one of the greatest countries, economically speaking, since history has begun. We in the United States have never won a peace. We've won several wars, but we have never won a peace because we always go to the defeated nation and provide them a means of recovery. Now this to me is an expression of concern for mankind, concern for other people, and to echo some of the other comments, an expression of Christian love. And war, speaking as an army officer, has never, ever settled anything except to bring a great deal of fear, pain, and exhaustion to the nations. But we saw what pacification did in Nuremberg. When the world decided, the United States alone, that Germany should be given Czechoslovakia, given Hungary, because they wanted living room. And that Hitler told the world, yes, I will, after I gain these countries, I will never go any further. And to the disgrace of the entire world, these nations, against their will, were summarily handed over to a dictator who then attacked the rest of the world. Maybe we should learn something about this. Maybe if we had expressed some love and concern for those nations, World War II would have never existed. Something to think about.
As one who observes human behavior and works with behaviors and mindsets and the like, I have a serious concern about what I think has been a subtle shift in how this country deals with war. I think it is the June 6th or June 7th was Victory in Europe Day, you know, very Passover, I think, for the most part. In the past, we have historically celebrated peace, we have been relieved as a nation, we have been greatly pleased as a nation, and our celebration as a nation has been something that has gathered around the fact that this terrible thing is being described by him. We're glad it's over. If you watched any of like CNN's coverage in the arrivals home, there were all the soldiers that were interviewed, many of them wished they were still over there to kick more butt kind of things. Clearly, the celebrations going on in Washington and New York and other places had little to do with celebrating peace. They were a glorification of war, or at least that was what was feeling a lot like to me. My concern, and I do, you know, from one individual person in trying to address this, is I have a serious concern about a nation that is finding a great deal of victory and a great deal to feel good about over beating up a two-bit dictator and his 1960s weapons. It says a lot to me about the self-esteem of the country. Are we in that poor of shape that we have to be so satisfied to beat up somebody? Sit down. Everybody said it from Schwarzkopf down. This was a shooting ducks in a barrel. It was not a problem. It was inevitable that it was going to happen this way. What is to celebrate about such a victory? I have a real problem with that. I think that might be where. It is where I personally, as a Christian, am going. You know, what's going on in our country that people are grasping on to something like this right now and saying, this really makes us feel good as a country? It doesn't me.
I'm going to ask David to give final comment, and then thank you all for participating. It went real quick, too quick, and as in the Holden tradition, please continue the conversation in other places.
Just a couple quick comments. I want to appreciate, your name is
Mike,
I really appreciate Mike's comment because I think it helps specify and put the issues in brass tacks. And I think, I know for me, I always appreciate when we talk about specific examples, which is why I chose the Gulf War myself, which is what I'm most concerned about. There's an immediacy to that. In terms of response to that, I just want to say, it was a matter of convenience to stop Hussein. There are all sorts of dictators we've supported, let alone stop. And Hussein himself, the Iran-Iraq war, there was 500,000 to a million casualties over 8 years. They invaded Iran in 1980. It was very clear Iraq was the aggressor. No actions by the United States, no mounting of troops, because Iran was our enemy at that point. And we supported Iraq. So I think it's important to understand the context. The last thing I want to say is that I think we often assume war is inevitable, and we used World War II as one of the major examples and the need to stop someone early, take him out, because we didn't take Hitler out. Well, if we tried to stop Stalin early and take him out, 45 years later, extraordinary changes took place in one country after another across Eastern Europe. Stuff that 3 years ago, if you'd asked anyone in this room, anyone in those countries, what is the possibility of change in your society? I'd say that's really a stupid question. Let's ask something realistic. Yet, in a relatively non-violent fashion, not using weapons, certainly not using the institution of war, the place turned upside down. Now, those countries are still very much in turmoil. It's unclear what's going to happen. But I think we have before us a real opportunity to learn from that, not to say this is a model that now we apply it to the Middle East, now we apply it to Latin America, now we apply it elsewhere, but that there was change, and that's filtering through. The Middle East, the Arabs are talking among themselves, just as people here are talking, of what sort of change like that can take place in our own societies. And what happened was Hussein and Bush together put a stop to that and said, no, we do not want, and we will not allow, that form of nonviolent change to take place. Might makes right. And they both said that, and one just happened to be mightier.
And let's continue.